Hey, y'all, my name is Jennifer Huddleston Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. I've been kept sober since December 5th of 92, and that's my miracle, and it is an honor and a privilege to get to be here. I want to thank the committee for all your hard work. I know that it takes a lot. It takes a village to put one of these bad boys on, and when it is done right, and this one certainly has been, we just walk in, and it feels like, oh, she's here. We can start. And that's absolutely how I felt at my first meeting, and I think that's a responsibility that we all share, is that when I showed up for my first meeting, the coffee was made, the chairperson was sitting in their place, the topic, well, I kind of brought that. But I mean, everything was already in place and they were ready to go. And it felt to me, even though I was coming out of my skin, I cried through that whole thing. I didn't remember just a good gob of what was said. But I do remember how I felt. And I felt like everything was in place ready for me to show up. And that's the way the newcomer is supposed to feel when they walk in. And because I've been to meetings where, you know, somebody's shoving the book across. I chaired the last meeting. Why do I have to chair this? You know, isn't it your turn, Frank? And sometimes we forget how that's going to look to somebody brand new. If we're not excited about Alcoholics Anonymous, why in the heck should they be? Because we're living in the good stuff. We're living in the promises. And they're coming out of their skin. It's an important thing for me to remember that when the newcomer shows up, they don't have a God of their own understanding. They have our kindness. That's what hooked me, was our kindness. And I don't know why I'm starting there, because that's never where I started before. But that's all right. I mean, we're just going to wing it, because I shared a bunch this morning. I don't know what's left. We're going to get to it at the end, but for the first 7 months of this year, my sister and I were walking my mama home, and on June 17th, she died, and it was a hard year, and there was a lot of fear, and there was a lot of AAs just circling the wagon. I mean, God showed up. He showed up and showed off. I mean, I'm not going to lie. But it was still a really painful year. My mama was not just somebody I saw on Easter and Mother's Day. We lived together. And so there's a presence missing in our home, and it's hard. And it's a transformative experience to get to walk your parents home. And so I'm not what I was, and I'm not what I will be. And I'm in this really awkward in-between spot where I don't know how I've been changed, but I know that I've been changed. I read somewhere that when a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, there's this in-between phase where the caterpillar basically liquidizes, and he's just a bag of goo. And that's kind of where I'm at. I'm just this big bag of goo waiting to see what we turn into. But I share about that because I suspect there's somebody here where it's their first conference. Or they're coming back. They used to have some time and they're coming back and they're not feeling what the rest of us are feeling. And I never want to forget how that feels. You know, like I know I need to be here, but I don't feel like I'm home. I don't feel like I belong yet. I'm not as, this whole sober thing's kind of intense. And that's okay, because you're not what you're going to be. You're not what you were before, and you're not what you're going to be. You're in the big bag of goo thing. And the cool thing is that we get to go through this over and over and over again, and it continues to be a transformative experience. We continuously, if we're doing it right, we get to become new creatures over and over and over again. I am not the same woman I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and certainly not who I was 29 years ago when I walked through the doors, and that's all your fault. So I also want to show everyone I have tissues. I will not use these tissues because I have a lot to talk about, but I have them. And the reason I show that is there are some people that when weeping begins in the meeting, they need to help. And they come running with, I call them the tissue bearers. And I don't know if you have them here, but we got a bunch of them in Texas. And they start running from the back of the room. Oh my God, there's precipitation, you know. And they got to help. I mean, and I know that that comes from a loving and caring place. But let me tell you what happens when you're the weeper. I don't know whether God's coming out or God's coming in, but something's happening when I cry. And anytime somebody comes and puts a tissue in front of me, it feels like, would you please stop? Would you please stop having this moment where you're connecting with God and your feelings? And so we need to let people feel what they got to feel. You know, if you hang around AA, you're going to get all your feelings back. I mean, all of them. And that's okay. This should be a safe place within, you know, the limits of the law to feel your feelings and to learn how to express them appropriately. And so I always like to show you I have tissues, but we're just going to talk and fling things around. And if that's problematic, call your sponsor. So probably ought to get to that story because she's windy and there's ice cream. And so I was born at a very early age on November 16th of 1966. That's my birth date is 111666 for you Revelations fans, which should have been a sneak preview for Tom and Charlotte. Tom and Charlotte were not drinkers. My parents were school teachers. My daddy was a football coach and a history teacher, and he was not the history teacher that you know, just showed films every day. He was the history teacher who dressed up like Benjamin Franklin to give the lecture. Whack-a-doodle-doo. And my mother was an English teacher, and she was that English teacher that wound up on your doorstep. She was the English teacher that you came back and thanked after your sophomore year in college. But when you couldn't play in the football game your senior year in high school, you hated her gut. And I know that because I went to the same high school my mama taught at, and people shared with me regularly. But my parents, they were not us, and there was not drinking in my home. And I kind of need to clarify that drinking wasn't good or bad at my house. It just wasn't. It just was not a part of our lives. There were never any lectures about it or the evils of alcohol or anything like that. My dad only had one drink in his entire life. He was in a hospital and he was prescribed a beer. And I don't really understand what happened there, but it's the only alcoholic beverage he ever drank. And I asked him about why he never drank, and he said, "Jen, honey, if I ever liked drinking as much as I like eating, we'd be in real trouble." Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. Because I don't know if y'all can tell, but I like me some groceries. I mean, everything really is bigger in Texas. And there was certainly a time when I liked drinking way more than I liked eating. But I had those kind of parents who met, they dated, they got married, and they had sex in that order. And in that order was a big deal in my family. And I was happy and healthy and wanted and loved and for almost 3 whole years. And then they brought home a bouncing baby resentment right before my 3rd birthday. She ruined everything. I know that this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but my first drug of choice was attention. And clearly I have not recovered from that. And she interfered with my attention, and I wanted homegirl sent back to wherever it was she came from. And that little feeling can rear its ugly head at any given Thanksgiving. y'all got a sister like that, too? Let me just tell you about her. She went to high school and graduated. She went to college and graduated in 4 flipping years. Just a ridiculous show off, that one. I'm 55 and a sophomore.
And I've been a sophomore for decades. I'm pretty sure at this point college algebra won. Because we've done battle many times, and I have never reigned victorious. And so when my sister graduated from college, she chose a career. She went to work for Jesus in Bulgaria. My sister was a missionary. Isn't that precious? I was a cocktail waitress in a pool hall. So we were both doing God's work in our own time. With the poor and downtrodden. I was just bringing them home with me, and she was giving them Jesus comic books. So while she was in Bulgaria, she met a Bulgarian man. They met, they dated, they got married, and they had sex in that order. And then they started making babies. And because them Jesus folks are breeders. And and she ruined any opportunity that I might have to blame my alcoholism on my upbringing. Because we went to the same schools, we went to the same church, we were potty trained in the same way, and we turned out totally different. And we still are pretty darn different. It's funny because, you know, going to the hospital and the assisted living, we look alike. And, but man, every time somebody would go, "You changed your hair," I go, "No, that's her. There's another one. She's different," you know. Because we've lived very different lives. Let's just be real honest about that, because I know some of y'all have family like this too. And when you've lived very different lives, and I have certainly had more colorful friends than she has had at her megachurch. You know, I mean, so, and it shapes our beliefs and our experiences and the way that we see the world. And sometimes that causes some difficulty connecting if we don't put God in the middle of it. And so, anywho, I married Big Daddy almost 13 years ago, and I'm just saying I wasn't a virgin. So one of these things just doesn't belong here. And for anybody who's new, for years I sat in AA, and I thought that we told this part of the story to explain why we're alcoholic. And I think it's pretty important to clarify, this is not why I'm alcoholic. The reason I'm alcoholic is covered in masterly detail in the doctor's opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if nobody has sat down with you and read the doctor's opinion in particular and talked to you about what the phenomenon of craving is, find somebody quickly and do that. I had a year of sobriety before somebody explained the phenomenon of craving to me. Now, I knew I drank too much too often. And I said I was an alcoholic, and I related to what you said in those meetings for that first year. But no one was very specific with me about the full scope of what our illness is. And because of that, I would sit in meetings like some people do here, I'm sure, and say, "Oh man, the craving was on me today." Being stone cold physically sober. You cannot experience the phenomenon of craving if you do not have alcohol in your body. But because it's the word craving, we think of it like Chinese food. And yet I have never gone to any lengths for an egg roll. Sold my soul and stolen from my mama's purse to have an egg roll, you know. It's a little bit different animal. And so it was really important today, it's really important for me to clarify, these things that I'm going to talk about are not why I'm alcoholic. The reason I'm alcoholic is alcohol and what happens to me specifically when I drink it. That does not happen for 9 out of 10 drinkers. They do not experience what we experience. They try. I mean, they try. And for years, I believed they drank like me or wished they could. No, they do not. I mean, I was really confused for a long time about that whole thing. I also thought that Peter Rabbit was a superhero story and not a cautionary tale. So I've been confused for a while. But anyway, I believe that baby Jennifer could have been born into any family anywhere, and if she had found some fermented fruit juice, you would have an alcoholic. That it has nothing to do with where I was raised, who I was raised by, or what happened while I was growing up. So why in the world are we held as part of our story? It's so that we can connect. It's so that we can connect. Because until I can relate to the things that went on with you before, and I relate to your thinking, your feeling, some of your behaviors even, like just that whole thing of, we both have that number 13. That seems like such a silly thing. And yet, when you're brand new and hanging on by your toenails, any connection at all helps. It helps a great deal. And so we tell stories, and there are different stories for different folks because we want to make that connection. We want to be able to say, yeah, me too. I felt that way, or I put myself in those situations, or I know somebody like that, or I drank with somebody like that. And that's why we tell this part of this story. So I'm growing up in this family, and what we do is we go to work, which is school, and we go to church. And everybody goes to school, and everybody goes to church. And church wasn't a bad place for me. It was not a scary place. It was not a place where bad things happened. I know that's not everybody's story, but it's mine. I mean, we're Methodists. Just do everything in moderation, and we're going to leave you alone. I mean, just bring some chicken to the potluck, and we're fine. And so I like church. I like being there. I like what I experienced there. I like being on the God Squad. Again, there's a lot of attention to get there, and that's my love language. And so it went so well for me that I thought I wanted to be a minister when I grew up. And there was just one little problem. I had a medical condition. I was boy crazy. And I wanted me a boy bad. I don't care what you heard. I wanted one bad. There was one little flannel phase, but for the most part, I really wanted me a boyfriend. And my problem is I scare the fish. I went through puberty about third grade, and boys discovered me in about 2007. So most of my story is just pretty much a Roadrunner episode. It's just me chasing stuff that does not want to get caught. But my story begins with a boy, because boys and drinking go together like peanut butter and chocolate, as far as I'm concerned. And so this boy moved to town, and he didn't know me, so he had that going for him. And he walked into the First Methodist Church, and I wanted what he had, and I was willing to go to almost any lengths to get it. And he was everything I knew I would never be. He was tan. He was toned. He had great hair. He was blonde. He had a waist. I've always wanted a waist. Even when I am smaller, I do not have a waist. I'm built like a fire plug. But he had a waist. He was a gymnast. He was preppy when preppy was the thing to be, and I was goth before goth even existed. And I wanted what he had, and I made it rather clear, and he's new in town and twitching, so he's perfect. He's sort of the lame antelope at the back of the herd. He found me fascinating, too, and we began to date, and we had a lot in common. We hated the same people. We were disillusioned by the same things. We both loved shoplift. We had a future, and before I ever had a drink, I had me some Alkalogic, and I started thinking, I want to keep him forever, because I'm in love like only a 16-year-old girl can be in love, and I need him forever. And so I came up with a cunning plan based on no information except rom-coms, and I decided he was going to deflower me, because I knew that if we had sex, we'd have to get married. Y'all are getting way ahead of me. And now, this is in the rules, y'all. Nobody else knows about this rule, so apparently I just made it up. But I really did think, okay, we're going to do the deed, and then he's going to be smitten, and we'll just live happily ever after. And so we went on a little date. We went to the mall, did a little light shoplifting. We were headed off to a romantic bistro. I was driving the car, because of course, and with Chili's. And I found a very romantic, secluded parking lot, and some Lionel Richie was playing or something equally as romantical, and could have been the Thriller album. I don't know what it was. But I didn't know what I was doing. I had just seen some Molly Ringwald movies, and so I'm going in with my move. I don't know how this is all going to work out, but I figure Mother Nature's going to kick in real quick. And right before she showed up, he popped right out of the closet. He was gay. In retrospect, there might have been a clue or two. But it never occurred to me that I should ask, am I your favorite flavor? What I know is that he was a young gay man from the South. And I don't know if there's a fun time to come out of the closet when you're a young gay man from the South, but I'm absolutely certain that the early 80s was not it. He was terrified. And it took a lot of courage for him to tell anybody. And he told me first. And I was so selfish and self-centered that I made it about me. I didn't react well. I made it about me. As a matter of fact, I spent the next 2 years trying to convince him he's not that gay. I'm a little go-getter, and he is. I checked, and my conversion therapy didn't work for nothing. And but I got mad at him, and I got mad at God, and I got drunk in them both. And let me just tell you how God shows up off before I get drunk. I hadn't seen him since prom my senior year. He was 1 year older than me, and he came back to take me to prom my senior year. And we looked so pretty in our pictures. I had a fuchsia dress on, a fuchsia bow tie, because he's gay. And I mean, we looked so yummy. And we had so much fun. And then I didn't hear from him for 10 years. And I got a call from an Atlanta area code, and I answered the phone, and he said, "Is this Jennifer Huddleston?" I said, "It is." And he said, "This is, oh, I probably shouldn't say his name." And he said, "I'm coming to Dallas for a work training. Could I take you to dinner?" And I have not talked to this man in 10 years. And I'm terrified, because I can only think of 2 reasons that he would call me. One is that he was very ill, and the other was that he needed a baby. And either idea kind of freaked me out. But I did kind of what you taught me to do. I said a prayer, and I said, "God, if I'm supposed to go, compel me to go." And God compelled me to go, and we went to dinner, and we talked for a little bit. And he said, "I don't even know why I called you. I just called you." In about 10 to 15 minutes, I knew exactly why he called me. And I spent the next hour and a half 12-stepping my gay boyfriend. And a year and a half later, because we often don't get it on the first try, I got to fly to Atlanta, Georgia, and talk at his first AA birthday. And he is still sober to this day and active in the fellowship here. And I love when God shows off with those complete circles. And I'm so thankful that I had done the work so that I had a message of depth and weight to share with him. And what I shared with him was that Alcoholics Anonymous is the best place I've ever been. And you're going to love it. You're going to love it. And he fell in love with you just like I did. But meanwhile, I'm mad at him, and I'm mad at God, and I'm getting drunk at them both. If you're going to start drinking at resentment, start at the top and work your way down. And this felt like the last in a long line of God's little practical jokes on me, because I grew up in Texas, the land of drill team, the land of drill team. My heart beats just like Barbie's, but my body is made by Tonka. And I'm so jealous of them little teeny tiny cheerleadery drill teeny girls, I can hardly stand it. And so I decided if he wasn't going to be my introduction to sin, I should probably try drinking. And my friends had started drinking in middle school, but I didn't, because I don't know if y'all remember middle school drinking, but it involves nose puking and being grounded forever. And I wasn't interested in vomiting out my nose. I mean, that just didn't sound like fun at all. And I can get grounded forever all by myself. And so I didn't drink. I just tried to take care of the drunk boys. Okay, I tried to take advantage of drunk boys. The problem is if they get drunk enough, there's nothing to take advantage of. But as I got a little bit older, I saw some older people drinking. It was a different experience. They would drink at Chili's, and they would drink frozen margaritas. That's how you know they weren't alcoholic. And, and these were some nerds, and they drank these frozen margaritas, and as they drank, they experienced a personality change. They could flirt and tell dirty jokes. They weren't drunks or anything. They just loosened up, and I watched this personality change come over them, and I thought, wait a minute. Now I'm interested, because I am made up of a lot of personality, and the rest is just straight carbs. And I figured if we could enhance my personality, there'd be no stopping me. Ominous warning. Anyway, so back in the day, y'all probably know there aren't that many children in the room. Once upon a time, there was no Google. And so if you needed to do research, you had to ask your dumb friends a bunch of questions. So I went to my dumb friends to ask them everything I needed to know about drinking. I'm a big researcher. I don't want to look dumb on my first, maiden voyage. And so I started asking 10,000 questions about drinking. And to shut me up, this girl gave me 2 bottles of wine left over from a party. I don't even know how to say that sentence. Leftover wine. What does that even mean? And in her defense, it was not good wine. It was a bottle of Boone's Farm Tickle Pink and a bottle of Real Sangria. This is wine that has never seen a grape. And let me tell you, it's not good under ideal circumstances. But what I did was I hid it in the back of my dad's Cutlass Supreme and drove around with it, rolling around in the back of that hot car for about 3 or 4 weeks. And I don't really know how to explain what happened to it, but it took on sort of a meaty quality. Something in sort of the gummy bear family. Anyway, it was weird. But it was the night before a church trip, and we were at Yolanda's house, and Yolanda was being no fun. She was fighting with a boyfriend back when phones were on walls. And me and Susie were there, and we were bored to tears, and that's when I remembered the 2 bottles of wine, and I asked Susie if she wanted to get drunk, and she said she did. Now, Susie was a Susie. She was a little tiny drill teamy girl. Yay! I mean, she had naturally curly blonde hair. Of course she did. She had giant pom-poms and a teeny tiny waist and could do the splits for no reason. Yay! And I don't know if you can tell, but I've had to do a little writing about girls like Susie. 4 columns, to be exact. Because girls like Susie say, I'm cold, and suddenly people are leaping over furniture to change the thermostat, grabbing blankets. Susie's cold. Jennifer, chop some wood. Susie's cold. And I'm that chick out in the parking lot changing her own tire, you know. I bet you Susie doesn't do this. You know? here's the thing that I know now that I didn't know then. Is that I made up the whole story about what Susie's life was supposed to be like. Susie is still my friend to this day. And I imagined that in her life, everybody was leaping over themselves to make life easy for her. And that's just a story I made up. Most Saturday nights, Susie was sitting at home with her boyfriend on her parents' couch watching wrestling. I mean, I like wrestling, don't get me wrong. But I didn't want to do that when I was in high school. I wanted to be wrestling. You know, everything that I envied her for wasn't necessarily even true, but it doesn't matter. The other thing that I learned through the inventory process in Alcoholics Anonymous was that the reason I changed my own tire was I never told anybody it was flat. I was so certain that no man would ever open the door for me that I never gave him an opportunity to. I was so sure that I was undesirable as a date that I didn't hear men who asked me out. I didn't hear it. They said it. I couldn't hear it. Because my belief system was creating my reality. I am the reason why I carried my own boxes and changed my own tires. I'm not saying that pretty girls don't get it a little bit easier. But it wasn't, but not to the degree that I believed it. Not to that degree at all. So we began to drink and man, some magical things happened. We started out closet drinkers. We sat on the floor of that closet and we drank those two bottles of wine. And as I said, Susie is still my friend today, and we have talked about that night. And if you ask Susie what happened that night, she will just talk about urine and vomit and broken glass and blood. I mean, just a whole lot of DNA, really. And I'm not saying that stuff didn't happen. I'm saying, why would you focus in on that part? Because for me, we laugh, we talk, we wet our pants, we puke, the window got broken. It was so much fun! Because see, there were some things Susie didn't even know. Susie didn't know that when we started drinking, I thought Susie was up here and I was down here. Susie didn't know that when we got one bottle down, we were neck and neck. Susie didn't know that as I drank that second bottle, I felt like I could take her at anything, including doing the split. And if drinking made you feel like it made me feel, you're probably here on a Saturday night. Because it changed my perception about absolutely everything. Now, that next morning was a little different. Had my first little baby hangover. I didn't know nothing about wine, and so I had never been thirstier in my life. Y'all remember that? Like, you wake up and it tastes like a hamster slept in your mouth. My tongue had grown hair. It was weird. I leaned over the bathtub and drank a couple of gallons of water. And then I headed downstairs, and that's when my stomach turned into a lava lamp. We were at a Hispanic girl's house, and her mother had made huevos rancheros for breakfast. So I puked again, and then I got on a bus to sing for Jesus, and I was both of those things, and I loved both of those things, and my book tells me right here I could quit, but why? I'm having fun. It makes me feel the way that I want to feel, and if there are consequences at this time in my life, I'm willing to pay them, because actually, other people are paying them. You know, if I hurt your feelings, I'll get another friend. If I wreck a car, Dad'll find me another one. If I wind up, you know, whatever it is, it seems like a small price to pay for the way that I feel when I'm drinking. And I don't recognize that it's relieving me of the bondage of self. That's what alcohol does for me, at least in the very beginning. In the very beginning, I would have been offended if you called me an alcoholic, and yet there were definite signs that I was not a normal or social drinker. For instance, if there are three girls and six beers, count me out. I have no desire. None. That's just a recipe for angry. I went through, there were like 19 words that went through my head, none of which were appropriate. See what you did to me? And limited my vocabulary. But anyway, I feel like a walking nerve ending. That start and stop gig, not good for us. Not my jam. And without even realizing it, I start rearranging my life to accommodate my drinking. And I that just sort of happened automatically. I didn't recognize any of this in real time, by the way. Sometimes it makes it sound like we saw this coming, and we didn't. I have always thought that maybe if there had been a soundtrack playing for my life, you know, then I would have known, like, I needed violins going, duh, you know, like, you make the wrong decision right here, you're not going to be able to, it's going to change the trajectory a little bit, you know. But instead I got, you know, I mean, I'm just sort of wandering around and crashing into stuff. And bless my heart, I mean, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know there was anything really wrong. I'm just a goofball. I mean, that's really what I thought. And yet, everybody else seemed so upset all the time. Went to college and I flunked out in record time, which I found offensive. Because I had taken a test that said I'd be real good at college. That says live. Because it assumed I might, show up at class. And that test didn't know nothing about Humongous, my first college boyfriend. He was a freshman too, but he was 28. He had a long beard and long hair, and he didn't like shoes. I mean, he was something. And he had some other stuff going for him too. He didn't have a job or a car. I know for some girls that would go on the con side of the list, but men tend to wander off on me. And I've noticed if you date a guy, and we're talking alka dating, you can drop him off somewhere, and when you come back later, he's still there. Or he's easy to track because he's on foot and looks like Sasquatch. And and we became boyfriends, and we became boyfriend and girlfriend, and it was magical. It was just magical because he wasn't super focused, so I liked having a boyfriend, so I got 5 or 6 more. Humongous like to do a little acid. I'm not going to talk about my drug use, but I will talk a little about his. He liked them hallucinogens, and I found that super duper handy. I became the chaperone for their acid trip, and that meant that I had 2 responsibilities. I had to make sure that they didn't run into the fire or touch sharp things. And I will say, my little drug friends, they were very organized. They did everything they needed to do before they took the drugs. And then they went off and, you know, danced naked in the field waiting for the mothership to come or whatever it was they were doing. Drunks, we do it in a different order. We get drunk and they go, you know what we need? We need a plan. And we start making a plan with no equipment, you know what I mean? And again, this is these lines that I start crossing, and I don't even notice that that's happening, that I'm rearranging my life, because these are not guys who are going to say, Jennifer, we're concerned about your drinking. They're all, ooh, you know, they're doing their thing. And I don't even recognize that the thing that makes them most attractive is that they're not interfering with the next drink. I don't even realize that I'm rearranging my life so that anything that comes between me and the next drink suddenly is disposable. And when I say anything, I mean anything. I mean any moral, any value, any person, any belonging, any job, any opportunity. It's all disposable. I will burn it to the ground for one drink. A drink that is no longer bringing me ease and comfort, but I remember when it did. So I flunk out of school, I make my big geographic, I move one zip code away. I'm not going to California. You can put a pin on my mama's house and go 30 minutes in any direction. And that's about as far as I get, because I know I'm going to need bailing out. And so I drive over a bridge and a lake, and it's a whole new world. And there I am. Wherever I go, there I am. And I'm bringing alcoholism with me, and it's progressive and it's fatal. And I don't even know I have it. But I know that the people around me doing the stuff that I'm doing, they're starting to die. I mean, they're starting to die from Hep C, from HIV, from suicides, from car wrecks. They're starting to die. And I'm sitting in this bar, and I'm wondering how my story's going to turn out different. Because I don't know how. And yet I don't know that I have alcoholism. I truly don't, because I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. It seemed like all the information I had showed people who grew up in it. Now, I found out later on there's a bunch up further in the tree, but nobody talked about it in my family. Nobody talked about it until people were dead. Well, Marcella got Ed sober. Marcella did not get Ed sober. Marcella drove Ed to the A&A and said, "You either get out here or you get out the house. Pick." That's how Marcella got Ed sober. But nobody ever talked about that. The story, the legend was, the love of Marcella saved Ed. I didn't even know he went to AA. I mean, because the legend was. So I'm wandering around life looking for somebody to love me like Marcella loves Ed. That's what I'm looking for, because I truly believe if I could find him and have me a little redheaded baby, and maybe we could live in a place that's surrounded by barbed wire. Because I tend to date men who wind up in the armed services. It's weird. We saw a pattern on my inventory. And it's not because I date particularly patriotic fellas. It's because after 2 years with me, a boat full of hairy legs sounds like fun. You're going to be screamed at every single day. You probably ought to make some money at it. And so they would enlist. Honestly, they would enlist to get away from me. That's what happened. And gradually things get worse. Chose a job with a hangover. I became a preschool teacher. Great job, except for all them kids. They got no volume control and no boundaries, and they can smell the blood in the water when you're hungover, man. It's right there, and which is every day for me. Miss Jennifer, Miss Jennifer, Miss Jennifer, hey. Miss Jennifer is detoxing. We are going to need to do something quiet. We're going to paste. Eat the paste. Paste each other. I don't really care. Let's let Miss Jennifer do a little regrouping right now, you know. And it's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. Because I began crossing some lines that I swore I would never cross. I swore that I would never, you know, be altered while I was watching kids. But while I'm working at that daycare, I began using other substances. I do not identify myself as an alcoholic and anything. I'm an alcoholic and an alcoholic. But I did use other substances in an effort to control and enjoy my drinking. And at the daycare, somebody offered it to me, and it seemed like a good idea. They told me it would allow me to last as long as the party, and I said, get out of my way. This thing that I had said no to many, many times, I suddenly said yes to, because it seemed like a tool to allow me to drink successfully. The other reason that I don't identify myself as an alcoholic and anything else is that at one point a DEA agent showed up at my apartment. I was running around with some manufacturers and distributors, not because I was into entrepreneurship, but because I'm thrifty. And these DEA agents showed up at my apartment looking for information, and they discovered I was dumb. And that's good news, but they did tell me that they were watching some of my friends. And they said if that I was still running around with those people, when they got picked up, that I would go to prison with them. And I believed them. I believed them. There's something about that badge. Did something real funny to me. I did not need a sponsor, a stiff metal chair, a three-ring binder, a column, nothing. I was clean in 24 hours. And it felt like I put on about 100 pounds in 72. I mean, I just, boom. I mean, I didn't have to explain to people I am no longer on the Jenny Crank diet. They knew. They were like, dude, okay. Look at her. Wow. I don't know. I drink and I get hungry. What can I say? And gradually things get worse, and there are jobs and no jobs and men and no men and utilities and no utilities. I didn't lose what other people lost while drinking because I forget to get it. I pick up a drink and I have a primary purpose, it is to get drunk, and I'm down to do whatever you want to do after I get drunk. But as I said, anything that comes between me and the next drink is disposable. I'm going home with strangers. And I hate talking about that, because I started out this story as a nice little Christian girl who wanted to be a minister. kind of like to say that I wasn't promiscuous. I just slept with a lot of people. And I wish I could stand here and tell you it was lust. I wish I could. I really do. That would be preferable to the real story. And occasionally it was, but for the most part it was a little more transactional than that. You see, I didn't keep alcohol in my home. And so when the bar shut down, I went home with anybody who would take me so that I could continue to drink. And it wasn't until I worked through the book with a sponsor that I realized why I did that. Because my sponsor said, I drank at home. What's your story? And I really had to think about it. And what happened was when I was 19 years old, one of my friends from high school that went to the same college I did, went to a party, got drunk, went home, passed out on his back, and never woke up. He asphyxiated on his own vomit. It's the last funeral I went to until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat at that funeral and I watched his mother sob. And she was broken by his death. And I don't know that she ever got okay again. And I sat in that pew and I knew, again, I would have been offended if you called me an alcoholic, but I knew I was that kind of drunk. And the decision that I made was that I cannot drink at home and I cannot drink alone. Because that is not safe. But sometimes my solutions are worse than my problem. And when you go home with people you do not know, when you turn your will and your life over to the care of people you do not know, things begin to happen. Things put dirty on you that soap doesn't wash off. And it's a big deal the first time it happens, and it's a pretty big deal the second time it happens. And by the third time it happens, I change the story that I tell. That's it. I change the story that I tell. And I just decide that it's all willing, because it is far easier to tell myself that I wanted to do it than to accept the fact that I didn't and that I traded my body for a couple of beers. I hate saying that part of my story. I hate that I felt that way about myself. But I think it's important to talk about where alcoholism takes us. And gradually things got worse. I moved back home with my mom and dad after this guy went into the Navy and we tried to plan a wedding, but he drinks like I drink, and he kept getting thrown in the brig and I kept forgetting to be faithful, and we kept postponing this wedding because we couldn't duct tape it together long enough to get down the aisle. And he kind of forgot and married some other girl. These alcoholic men lack focus. And I moved home with my mom and dad, and I had been alternating jobs between working in a bar and working in a daycare. The daycare would get a little rigid about wanting me there every day, fully closed, ready to function. They were really big on that kind of stuff, which seemed very rigid. And so right before I'd get fired, I'd quit and I'd go work at the bar for a while because I had some transferable skills. Drunks and four-year-olds are pretty much the same thing. But the problem there was that I could drink all day and all night, and there were no bumpers to my, you know, drinking, and that gets out of hand real quick for somebody like me, and then I'd run back to the daycare and eat some fish sticks and sing some songs about animals, and then they'd bring me into the office again so that I could get written up for being late. I'm just that kind of drunk who just can't, I mean, they're begging me to just be good for 2 weeks, and then they can give me a raise, or they can, you know, send me to school, or they want to help me. And I get right up, man, I make it 13 days. But on that 14th day, I can't show up. I just can't show up. But, man, those daycare ladies, they tried hard because they're helpers. And I like them a lot, you know, and I got in trouble again for being late, and they never talked to me really about my drinking, or maybe they did and I couldn't hear them, who knows. There was one director who stopped me in the parking garage and said, hey, are you a party girl? And I said, yes, do you want to go to happy hour? And I remember the look on her face, but I had no understanding of why she had that look on her face. Today I know it was disgust, because she was trying to let me know she knew, and it was a problem. And so I moved back home with my parents. I've collected a couple of DWIs by now. The first time it was just what happens to every party girl. We all get one. Less than 6 months later, I got a second one. That was shocking. My attorney had predicted that might happen and had given me instructions about what to do when they pulled me over again, and I thought that was weird. Because I kind of looked at a DWI like, you know, the patches in Girl Scouts. And I got my patch. I don't need a second one. And I realized I hadn't told my attorney that I had a plan. It was to be more careful. Some folks can figure out the problem with the plan. I'm drinking the no care juice, vowing to be more careful. And I get that second DWI, and that's when I decide I have a problem. I have a driving problem, and I'm going to solve my driving problem, and problem solved. And so I move next door to my bar of choice, problem solved. Only wherever I go, there I am, and I'm bringing alcoholism with me, and it's progressive and it's fatal. So I moved back home with my mom when we called off that wedding with the Navy guy. And for the last year of my drinking, I am drinking in one town and living in another. I'm driving through three counties every night drunk. I am walking into my parents' house at 2 and 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning wasted. They are, you know, they're good Christian people who are getting up to go to work and teach kids in the morning. And I'm stealing money from the wallet and their purse, and I'm bouncing off the cabinets, and I'm eating their food. And I don't really speak anymore. They're watching me turn gray, and I don't laugh, and I don't sing, and I don't cut up. They're watching me die one day at a time. And they don't bring it up very often because they are so afraid. I have become so volatile that they are so afraid that I will overreact and run out of there, and they won't know where I am. And for some reason, they feel like if they know where I am, I'm safe. And yet I'm not. And there's nothing they can do except be angry. That's all they know how to do is just be angry. And I'm walking around in that alcoholic arrogance saying, I don't know what they're so angry about. I'm only hurting myself. And there's the big lie.
Yeah.
I'm only hurting myself. And I'm holding those poor people hostage. And I'm telling myself I'm only hurting myself. And gradually things get worse. On November 19th of 1992, I got pulled over on a felony with DWI. I was 3 days late for my own birthday party. Whoops! Because I started drinking in one place, and I don't really pause real well to get to another place. And I had asked them to throw me that party, and then I didn't show up. That's the level of my selfishness and self-centeredness. But some people had bought me some drinks and left some gifts for me. And so I showed up 3 days later to collect my stuff. And I drank like I normally do. It wasn't a good day or a bad day, it was a day. And I was driving back home with my presents in the car, and I saw the red lights behind me. And the only thing that was different that night was that I told the truth. And no one was more shocked than me. No one. I mean, everybody in this room, including the Al-Anons, know what we're supposed to say if they say how much have you had to drink. That would be a couple. Thank you very much. I know this. It is part of my DNA. And yet, this police officer walks up to the side of my car and he says, how much have you had to drink? And I say, $67 worth. I did not know how many drinks I had had. I did know how much my tab was. And I'm just going to remind you, this is 1992 money. We were not drinking $12 cocktails. I was drinking $1 draw beers and shots. I drank cocktails if you were buying. As I said, I'm thrifty. But they took me to jail, and I had a moment of clarity sitting in a jail cell because it's a pretty good place to have one. And my moment of grace was simply that I saw myself exactly as I was in that moment. I could no longer say, what's a nice girl like me doing in a place like this, because I'm no longer a nice girl. I'm nowhere close. I can't tell myself that there's been some big misunderstanding, because of course there hasn't. I was drunk, I was driving, and I'm a danger to myself and other people, and I know it. And the thing that I know even more than that is that I can't swear to me, God, or anybody else that I won't do it again, because I will definitely do it again. If you let me out, I will do it again. And if I can't swear to me, God, or anybody else that I will not be a danger to myself or to other people, I belong in a cage, and I know that with an amazing amount of clarity that night. I know that, and it frightens me. And I say a prayer, and I ask God for help, and I meant it sincerely. and I made a decision that I was going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had visited y'all. I mean, I didn't join or nothing. But I had visited y'all. And that night, AA seemed like my only hope. And then they let me out. And when they let me out, I made a terrible error in judgment. I did not run to you. I tried to cover up the mess. And the longer I waited to come see you, the less that idea sounded good. The longer I waited to come see you, the more frightened I became of what sobriety might be like. Because I'm not drinking, and I am coming out my skin. It's like, you know, that toothache feeling, except my whole body. You know, I'm this walking nerve ending, and I'm not drinking. And it's bad. It's bad. And the longer I think about it, the more frightened. Who am I if I don't drink? And how do you do life and not drink? And I'm going to feel like this forever? But I'm still, there's a part of me that knows I've got to get to AA. I know I've got to get to AA. And so I start orbiting this group. I got there one night accidentally, right at meeting time. I almost had to go in, y'all. It was close. But I got that Alcologic, and that Alcologic said, "You can't go rolling into AA without an AA book. What are you doing?" And so, y'all, I left the place where the AA books live to go on a quest. You know, I probably should start my story right there. I mean, that really qualifies me, that arrogance, that I've got to go get my book before I can show up at your meeting. So I went to the Barnes & Noble to get me an AA book. They have them there. They were expensive. I mean, this was 1992. That thing probably cost $4.99. It was ridiculous. And I was not that optimistic about Alcoholics Anonymous, so then I had to go to the half-price books, and they got AA books there. But the problem with the half-price books is the willy-nilly highlighting. Willy-nilly highlighting all over the first 23 pages of the book. The rest of the book is clean as a whistle. But that first 23 pages, all kinds of jacked up. And I'm so arrogant. It's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. I'm so arrogant, I think I can't let some loser influence my opinions about Alcoholics Anonymous with their willy-nilly highlighting. And 3 days and three half-price bookstores later, I finally find a clean copy worthy of my study. Then I can't go to the meeting because I got to read the book. So I'm reading the book by myself, detoxing. And it's not going well, y'all. Does not seem like there's any good news in this thing at all, which is weird because it says this is the good news. This book has a... Where the hell is it? There's a bunch of talking about not drinking, and I'm not drinking right now, and it's not going that swell. And I had this attorney that I hired. He worked out of his garage, and that's the dude I can afford. And I go see him about this felony DWI, and he said best case scenario I'd do a year. And I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, but I'm not tough. I am not tough. I have a lot of skills, many that involve air conditioning and snacks. But jail is not one of my particular skills. My weapon of choice is projectile weeping. And I like to play the crazy card. But I only have like three crazy cards. And in jail, for those of you who have not stayed at the Cross Bar Motel, there are girls with whole decks of crazy cards up in the jail, and I cannot hang with these women at all, and I'm scared to death. I really am. I'm sort of getting suicidal, and I'm reading the book by myself, and I'm not drinking, and I'm getting a little more suicidal with every day that passes. And then I remembered this friend of mine, Jimmy, and Jimmy had 8 DWIs, and he was still drinking at my home bar. And I'm thinking, here's a man with a real answer. I've been driving around the AA group, but I don't have the maracas to walk in. But I know this guy's got 8 DWIs, and he's still drinking in a bar, and my attorney's telling me I'm going to do a year in jail, and I need to talk to Jimmy before I bother you nice people. I mean, AA can be Plan BB. Because I got to talk to Jimmy because I'm coming out of my skin, and this is not going to last. And And so I went to a bar, and I went to a bar, and I say that, but I'm not going to drink, whatever. You think I'm an idiot? I'm just going to talk to my legal advisor, Jimmy the criminal. And, you know, the stuff that made so much sense back in the day now sounds kind of stupid when you say it out loud. But I think I'm going to consult one of the great legal minds of our time, Jimmy the criminal, and he happened to be at my home bar that night. What are the odds? And I walk in, and they put my drinks on the bar like they did every time I walked into my home bar, except for the first time in my life I said, I'm not drinking tonight. I'm just here to talk to Jimmy. And they said, okay. And I sat across from the guy that I considered to be the worst drunk I knew. And the reason I thought he was the worst drunk I knew is that he had a son who got in, had an accident and wound up in intensive care. And every day while his son was in intensive care, Jimmy would show up at the bar and he'd say, I'm not staying very long. I'm going to have one drink and then I got to go see my boy. And I understood Jimmy. He had to have that drink to go see his boy. Only the problem is once we have that one drink, he never went to see his boy in the hospital. That's why I thought he was the worst drunk I knew. Today I know Jimmy's just like me. And that's what happened. I start telling him about the trouble I'm in, and he said, oh, Jen, honey, I can afford to be the kind of drunk I am. You can't afford to be the kind of drunk you are. And today what I know is that Jimmy was talking about money. Apparently Jimmy had been paying his attorney with cocaine. And, and I didn't happen to have any cocaine. And, which was obvious. And Jimmy said that all his attorney was doing was postponing things, and he said he was going to go to prison and he'd go for a really long time. But Jimmy thought that this might be an opportunity for me to find a new way to live. When the worst drunk you know is drinking and 12-stepping you, you are having a real bad day. I'm just saying, I could have kicked that dude right in the baby maker. You know, I can't pass college algebra, but 8 DWIs is more than 3 DWIs. And yet there was a little voice inside of me that sounds like me but isn't me, and it kept saying, who would know better than Jimmy? Jimmy knows how you drink, and he knows how you think, and he knows how you feel. Jimmy knows. The other thing that happened that night was at some point there were drinks in front of me, and at some point I drank them, and I don't remember drinking them. Not because I had too much to drink that night, although for an alcoholic, any drink is too much to drink. But I don't remember drinking them because I didn't make a decision to drink. As a matter of fact, I made a decision not to. And I get chills every single time I tell this part of the story. I drank against my will. I knew how much trouble I could be in if I drank and drove again. I knew that I could not touch it. And yet at some point that evening, those drinks that were poured earlier in the night were slid in front of me. And I don't remember drinking them. I don't remember deciding to drink them. I remember looking down and seeing empty glasses and knowing what I had done. And it scared me to death because I knew I would drink. I would drink whether I wanted to, whether it was a good idea, whether it was, I was just going to drink if something didn't change. And that's how I showed up to you. Thank God that's how I showed up to you. I'd been trying since 7 in the morning to get to a meeting, and I showed up at a 10 p.m. meeting. I'd been orbiting that thing all day long and hating my own guts that I didn't have the courage to walk through the door. But at 10 p.m. on a Friday night, I finally reached the jumping-off place where I could no longer imagine life with or without alcohol. And that's when I walked into the Plano group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the Plano group was a dumpy little group. It was the kind of place where furniture goes to die. Y'all probably have a couple of like when Grandma says, we got to get rid of the couch, it goes, Meemaw, let's be honest. When Meemaw says, get rid of the couch, it goes to the Plano group, and man, bad things happen on that couch. Sometimes I want to Luminol some AA furniture just to see what happens. But I came in and I sat where the newcomer likes to sit, which is as close to the door as humanly possible. You guys were sitting at the other end of the room in a little circle, and I was sitting back there. I make it sound like it was a monstrous place. It was a dumpy little one-room house. But they seemed like they were a long way away, and I'm sitting close to the door. Now, I had made a deal with God that I would stay for one meeting, and if I heard something I could hang on to, I would come back for one more. I wasn't super humble, but that was the most I could muster, and God can work with that much willingness. And so I'm sitting next to that door because I don't know if I can keep that promise. And if I got to run, I don't want to be tripping over any of y'all on my way out the door. And they turned out the lights and they lit the candles and I knew I was in a cult. But it didn't matter because I had nowhere else to go. I had nowhere else to go. And right before the meeting started, somebody said, hey, there's a chair over here in the circle. Why don't you come sit with us? And for reasons I cannot explain other than God's grace, I moved from that chair to the circle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I truly believe that my recovery began when I surrendered my ideas and started trying yours. That's when my recovery began. Because I have not had a drink since that day. Now, I've had to do a couple of things to keep that chair. But as you heard earlier today, there were also times when I wasn't doing the things I needed to do to keep that chair. And God's grace kept me sober. And I... that makes me uncomfortable to say because I don't want anybody to risk it. There's no reason to risk it. There are solutions all around us. But I'm just going to tell the truth about my story. For the most part, I have been an active and enthusiastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But maybe I'm here because during those times when I wasn't an active and enthusiastic, the time, and I don't want it to sound like there were 14 of them. There was one stretch of time where I was not an active and enthusiastic member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was still sponsoring. I was still praying every single day. I was still reading my literature regularly. I was still carrying the message. I don't want it to sound like, oh, I just sat and ate Cheetos. My heart wasn't in the way that it is now. That's really what was going on. And I was disconnected from my spiritual advisor. That's what happened. And thank goodness I stayed close enough and connected enough that God had room and time to intervene. So I'm sitting in that meeting and I'm listening for this solution. And I haven't gone to treatment. And I've read the book, but it's not going well. You know, I haven't read all of it by any stretch. But I'm sitting in that meeting and I'm listening for that thing that's going to save my life. And God love a duck, y'all are so excited to see me. You can hardly stand it. Only problem is, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Oh, this is so fantastic. You're going to get a sponsor and come to the big book the big book picnic. And we're going to do the three legs, and I'm like, what in the heck is happening here? Because y'all are speaking your lingo, only I don't speak your lingo. I don't know what you're talking about. And the longer you talk and the less I understand, the more defeated I become. Because if I don't even know what you're saying, and I'm certainly not humble enough to raise my hand and say, what is any of this that you're saying? What are you saying? The more defeated and frightened I become because maybe there's not a solution here. And if there's not a solution here, what happens to somebody like me? And lucky for me, about halfway through the meeting, one of my greatest teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous began to share. His name was Gene, and he was wearing bib overalls. That may not be a big deal to anybody else, but I got a special place in my heart for bib overalls. I believe when we get to heaven, they're going to hand us a kolache. And some, if you don't know what a kolache is, it's a delicious pastry. And they're going to hand us a kolache, and they're going to hand us some bib overalls and our wings. And maybe some arts and crafts supplies. I don't know for sure. But I'm pretty positive we're going to all be wearing bib overalls in heaven because they're glorious. And Gene had long hair and a long beard and kind of Duck Dynasty style and a camo fishing cap. And I believe that guy had had a drink or two. I wasn't sure about the rest of you. You looked a little too clean and shiny on me, you know. You looked like you had drank juice or milk or something. But I believe Gene had had a drink. Not that day, but someday, you know. And the reason Gene's one of my greatest teachers is he knew how to talk to a newcomer in a way that a newcomer could hear. And what Gene said was, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. Hell, I just thought I was thirsty. Me too, Gene. I mean, it would have been profound if he had stopped there. But he didn't. He said, the more I drink, the thirstier I get. And that starts with the very first drink. And from that day to this, it's the most elegant way I've ever heard the phenomenon of craving described. The more I drink, the thirstier I get. It begins with the very first drink. And that man solved the mystery I've been working on for 10 years of daily drinking, because I'm a bar drinker and a bar drunk. I walk into a bar and I watch them. Some of them got watches on. I've never understood why. They'll tell you when to go home. You don't need a watch. But those losers wear watches. They have one drink, maybe two. They'll have a kamikaze on their birthday, you know, and then they'll look at the watch and the watch says go home, and here's where it gets weird. They go home. I know, because I followed a couple of them. One drink, maybe two. Oh, look at the time. Mama's got dinner waiting on me. I've got to go. And I would think, why would you do that? We have pretzels here. One drink, maybe two. Oh, look at the time. The game's about to start. And I would think, we have TVs here, here, and here. Why would you do that? But I'm a daily drinker and a daily drunk, and my question changes from why would you do that to how do you do that, because I can't do that. And I don't understand why. And Gina explains it perfectly. The more I drink, the thirstier I get. It begins at the very first drink. Nothing is ever quenched when I drink. Nothing is ever quenched when I drink alcohol. It always ignites the phenomenon of craving. And I will always crave more. And I will live my entire life in service to that more. Unless I get a spiritual advisor, we call them sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless I ask that spiritual advisor to teach me how to take 12 principles and to apply them in my life, like my life depends on it, because it does. Unless in the process of learning about these 12 principles, I develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I mean an everyday, all day long relationship. Not Mother's Day, not Easter, an all day, everyday relationship. And what Gene said was that since he developed a relationship with a power greater than himself, that he called God, but he said we could call him whatever we wanted to. He said he hadn't had a first drink and he hadn't been thirsty in a real long time. And I wanted what that guy had, because I understood what that guy was talking about. He shared something I'd never told anybody. And he shared it in a way that I understood. And at the end of the meeting, they asked me if I'd like to share, and I haven't shut up since. And in that meeting, there were a whole bunch of Andas, and I only knew of one other 12-step program, and I did not believe that I belonged in that. And it made me really nervous, because I want to fit in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I said when I introduced myself, my name is Jennifer, and I'm an alcoholic, and a thief, a whore, and a liar. I did not know that once you said alcoholic, you pretty much got the rest of that covered. Truly not necessary to be that specific. But I told you a little bit about how I was dying one day at a time, and I told you a little bit about the things that I was ashamed about. And I told you that the thing I was most ashamed of was that I knew I could never get or stay sober by myself. And those tacky people smiled and nodded. I really thought they should weep with me. Because I thought AA, we were just going to sit around and be sober. Just, how long have you been sober, Frank? 4,000,223 days. You know, we drink some broth and sing some hymns and be sober. And I've been to a couple of groups like that. But the most part, that's not what y'all were like at all. And as they smiled and nodded, what I learned was that you can fool the fans in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you can't fool the players. And that night I was just desperate enough to be a player in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason they knew I was desperate enough to be a player was they told me to go to Denny's, and I went. You don't ask a newcomer to do nothing. Because our brains are eating our faces off. We don't know what you're going to do to us. If you had asked me to go to Denny's, I would have said, oh my God, I mean, I've got the board meeting in the morning. Would have made up some kind of crazy story. But you told me to go to Denny's, and I went. And I remember, it's one of the few things that I remember very clearly besides what Gene said. And I remember that I went to Denny's because I thought that's where you filled out the paperwork to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I did not fill out any paperwork, I do believe that I went to AA orientation, because I learned some things. I learned that you guys laugh at things that are not funny. You share things you should not share, especially not in public. And I don't know why they call us anonymous, because you got no volume control. And you love to say stuff like, isn't that just like an alcoholic? And I am horrified. Because I don't know that if you're at Denny's at 1:30 in the morning, you're either a member of AA, a future member of AA, or a square dancer. I don't really understand it. But that's who was at our Denny's at 1:30 in the morning. But what I saw there is what I saw here. It's the glue that traps little baby alcoholics. It's a fellowship of friendliness and understanding that is indescribably wonderful.
Yes.
And it was just wonderful enough that I went home and I prayed to a God that I knew had given up on me. Why wouldn't He? He had blessed me and He had chosen me and He had given me gifts. And I had spat on all of them. I had walked away from every single thing God ever blessed me with. And I traded it for a drink every time. Why would God care? But you told me to do it, so I did it. And I went to the next meeting I could get to, and I walked in the door. And another one of God's little army showed up, and he said, "Hey, is your name Jennifer?" And I said, "Why? What have you heard?" And he said, "Is your name Jennifer?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you drink today?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Welcome to your second day of sobriety." And he set the hook. He set the hook. And the big deal was not that he knew it was my second day of sobriety. At that point, 2 days of sobriety meant nothing to me. The big deal was he remembered my name. That was what set the hook for me. And that is service work that any of us can do. I don't care if you got to write it on your hand. I don't, call them precious. It doesn't matter. Just talk to them. Remember them. Pay attention. Take a minute. Miss a beat. Tell them they're doing good. Ask them if they got a sponsor. See if they've got a book. That's all it takes. We're starving to death for kindness. I didn't know. I thought it was the alcohol that was killing me. It was the loneliness. It was the loneliness. And you treated the loneliness first. And you spoon-fed me, God, with your kindness. Now you also teased me mercilessly, which is another form of love. You teased me into right action. I kept showing up at meetings late, not because I had to, just because, you know, time. Fluid. And hopefully I've recovered from that. But I would show up late, and this friend of mine said, "You know, Jennifer's real special. She can't read a clock with hands." Oh, and he embarrassed me. I mean, I laughed because you guys thought it was funny, but I showed him. I started showing up at those meetings early. I was a timekeeper. Bet you wish I was still a timekeeper now. But anyway, and man, I was dying for the day he walked in 2 minutes late. I couldn't wait, you know. Somebody teased me about, you know, "We knew you were coming 15 minutes ago." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "We heard the crap in your car rattling around from 4 blocks ago." I showed them. I cleaned out my car at them. You know, I mean, that's just what started happening. And being in AA, I can't remember. I think it's Norma who used to say, being in Alcoholics Anonymous is like being kicked to death by a rabbit. It's just this slow erosion of your will, and that's what happened to me. Was just, you guys just loved the feathers off of me one day at a time, and you just were relentless. I mean, it just got to the point where I was either going to have to get a sponsor or go get drunk, you know. And I adored you. Why would I get drunk? And so I got a sponsor, and then that sponsor was just relentless. And we're going to have to do some steps. And she didn't know how to do all of them, but we had to do the ones she knew how to do. And then by then, you know, I've got a boyfriend picked out, and I'm coming up on a year, and so I got to get a different sponsor so that I can get enough steps done that he'll date me. And gradually things got better. One day at a time, little by slow. With you guys just loving me right where I am. What I'm like today is I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a program that works in fair weather and foul. I've had pretty much the hardest year I've ever had in my life. But God's shown up and showed off in a really big way. And every step of the way, God has given me what I needed. and he has surrounded me with the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before things started going awry with my mom, my sister and I got into a fight. As I said, we have lived very different lives and we have very different beliefs. And I don't know if y'all heard about it, but there's some polarizing stuff that's been going on for the last couple of years. and there are some topics that my sister and I simply cannot discuss. We just can't discuss them. I'm not going to see it her way and she is not going to see it mine. And yet, her husband said something to my mother and really we were having a playful conversation. And I mentioned what her husband said to my mother, and it started out kind of, ha-ha, when did he do that? That's kind of crazy, ha-ha. And then something snapped, and I don't know what snapped, and I don't know why, but it snapped, and the conversation took a quick left. And my sister and I do not fight often, but when we do, well, we might as well just air our spleens, you know, and we're going to do, if I got to make amends, let's make them good ones. And that's what happened. We cracked the lid on that thing and we were going to finish it. And we don't cuss at each other. I mean, nothing like that. But it was just kind of, we both were talking down to each other and pushing those buttons we know work. And I hung up that phone and I just, that dread, that sick feeling came over me, especially because I knew I was wrong. I introduced a topic we cannot discuss. So I sent a quick text apologizing for bringing up a topic we cannot talk about. And she said something along the lines of, well, I'm sorry if you got your feelings hurt. And then I sat with it. And the longer I sat with it, the more I thought, uh-oh, not this time. Nope, not doing it this time. Nope. I am always the one who has to make the amends. I am always the one who has to make it right. I'm always the one who has to mend sentences. She's a big C Christian. She's supposed to be doing this stuff. Maybe it's her time this time. And I was doing some spiritual writing with a sponsee. Actually, I was trying to trick her into doing the steps. It didn't go that great. But I was doing some spiritual writing with this sponsee. And every time I would sit down to have my time with God and do this spiritual writing, God would tell me rather clearly, you need to pray for your sister. And I would say, she needs to pray for me. It's her turn. And I'd sit down and try and have time with God, and God would say, Jennifer, it's time for you to pray for your sister. And I would say, why do I always have to be the one? Why is it always me? Why is it always me? And God answered me really clearly and said, because you're the one who can. It's always been that way. She has followed you her whole life. And if you lead to peace, she will follow you there. And I was so mad. Because really, it should be her turn. But God wasn't going to leave me alone. So I started praying for my sister. I haven't had to pray for somebody like that in a long time. And I'm praying in this journal, and I'm asking God for specific things, and I want to throw up in my mouth every time I write it. Please send Jill something that makes her inexplicably joyful today. God, please, you know, allow Jill to find something that makes her heart happy, or whatever. I mean, it was just... And all I did was pray for her. I did nothing else. Nothing else. I just prayed for her. It was right around Thanksgiving, and she and I split holidays, and she called me up. She called me early. She never calls me early. She called me early to plan the holidays. And what she doesn't know is that we had Thanksgiving at my house for years because she had kids, and so she always had Christmas. Well, now her kids are grown, and so now we can kind of pick and choose. And what she didn't know was that I really want Christmas. But because we'd had this big fat fight and because she was calling early to plan and because I just had started praying for her, I was like... She said, what holiday would you like? And I said, I don't care. I'm lying. I am lying. And I said, and she said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I'm sure. I really don't care. You can pick. We can do either one. It doesn't matter. And she said, well, if you don't care, I mean, I can. And I said, I really don't care. You'll pick. And she said, well, if you don't care, I'd really like Thanksgiving. And I hung up the phone and thought, okay, I see you. I see you. That was in November. In January, my mother broke her ankle, and she never re-entered our home again. She wound up in the hospital, and then she wound up in assisted living, and then there was cancer, and she never came back home. And I have written evidence that God knew that my sister and I were going to have to get along, and we were going to have to get along in a way we have never, ever gotten along before. And God was relentless in telling me to pray for my sister. My mother had a little bit of a hoarding problem. She wasn't ready for an A&E episode, but she had a hoarding problem, and there was no way that I could have gotten all the stuff taken care of and her stuff moved out and the things that needed to be done and the papers that had to be gone through. I could not have done it without my sister. God was relentless and told me to pray for my sister. We've had lunch almost every week for months now. And at my mom's funeral, I gave the eulogy because I didn't think. And I've never met a microphone I didn't like until that day. And the only time I really lost it during that eulogy was talking about how my sister and I finally became the sisters my mother wished we had been the whole time. That was my last gift from my mother. Was that she built a bridge between the two of us without meaning to or knowing what was going on, and that she would be really proud about how we walked her home together. So my mom's been gone for a little while. I promise I'm wrapping it up. Y'all are going to get to be home before midnight for sure. Or I've got a little extra room. I got a king bed and a chair. But after my mom died, I was a little mad at God. I'm not going to lie about it. I was really kind of annoyed at. There's a thing that kind of comes back for me. It may happen for y'all too, where every now and then I play the, well, you have all the power card. Like, I mean, buddy, look, she deserved a better death than that. It was just hard. There was hope, and then there was no hope, and then there was hope, and then there was no hope, and it went on for 7 months of just, if we can just get to here, it'll all be okay. If we can just, and then none of it worked out the way that I thought it would. It was just hard. I was writing in my journal, and I have a relationship with God where I could talk to him pretty honestly. And I said, God, I just don't understand. And there's this phrase that kept coming up as I wrote about it, about the hand of God seeming heavy or even unjust. That's all I could remember was my beef with God, not the rest of the paragraph. So after the sixth or seventh time that kind of went through my head, I went and looked it up. And it's in the 11th step in the 12 and 12. In AA, we have found that actual good results of prayer are beyond question. They are matters of knowledge and experience. All those who have persisted have found strength, not ordinarily their own. They have found wisdom beyond their usual capability. And they have increasingly found a peace of mind which can stand firm in the face of difficult circumstances. We discover that we do receive guidance for our lives to just about the extent that we stop making demands upon God to give it to us on order and on our terms. Almost any experienced AA will tell how her affairs have taken remarkable and unexpected turns for the better as she tried to improve her conscious contact with God. She will also report that out of every season of grief or suffering, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons for living were learned, new resources of courage were uncovered, and that finally, inescapably, the conviction came that God does move in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. And I could see the ways in which God had shown up, and I could see the healing that happened with my sister. And I had a little bit of peace about the way that my mom went home. Maybe it was necessary for us to be able to let her go because it had been so hard at the end. And I was just asking God for peace with my past. And I thought, you know, the hardest part for my mom was leaving her granddaughter. She would never do that willingly. And then I remembered. my first year that I was married to Big Daddy, I had a miscarriage. And I thought, there's a baby waiting for her in heaven. And I don't care if that's a fairy tale or not. It was a secret little surprise that I held in my heart. And every time I thought about my mother, I thought about everybody who was waiting for her. And I thought about the joyful reunion. And that's your fault. I stopped thinking about my loss. And I started thinking about what she gained. And I know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I have gotten to have some peace with that, which doesn't mean there aren't big waves of just missing my sweet, sweet mom. But 3 weeks ago, I met a new guy. He was doing time, and he'd been doing time for a while. I actually went to meet another guy, but there was no chemistry. And every volunteer at that shelter said, "Have you introduced her to Elroy yet?" And me and Big Daddy met Elroy. And Elroy is a little shelter dog, and he's just rotten as the day is long. And he has come to be our new roommate. I was never a dog person. Never. I don't like your dog. I'm just telling you right now. I don't want to be licked on. I don't want drooly balls. I don't want any of it. Until Elroy. And Elroy came into our home and he started healing my heart. He laid on my side. Laid on the floor on my side of the bed, and that first Saturday that we had him, the first Sunday morning when we had him home, he and Big Daddy got up early and took a walk, and then they shut the door so that I could sleep in, and I came out, and he did that little dance that they do, and he just was so, and he needed to hug me, and I just stood there and bawled, and I thought, God picked me a dog. Why would anybody leave this dog at the shelter? This is the best dog ever. And we decided that Elroy was still there because he needed to come be with us. He needed to come heal our hearts. My big book says that if I stick close to God and perform his work well, he will allow me to match calamity with serenity. But I cannot do it alone. I have to have you. Because sometimes you're going to point out to me the things I can't see. Because sometimes you're going to hear the things that I can't hear. Because sometimes you're going to remind me that God just does not ever stop loving us. He just never does. And nothing I can ever do will make him love me any less. And nothing I can ever do will make him love me anymore. But if I'm not sober, I'll never experience it. I'm living the best life I can imagine, even in the hardest year I've ever had. And I blame you. I'm glad to be here, and it's a good day.